From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Opening day has come, and it has gone, offering the seasonal splendor of white turf, sleet, and shivering fans. Ahead are Only a Game and MLB Primer with the always warm and sunny Tim Kirkjian. Also, two, count 'em, two Final Four updates, and meet the man whose dreams of the Final Four yielded to the reality of single parenthood. Also ahead, the life of the late Negro League executive Effa Manley, the only woman enshrined in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
She is very attractive. She is very bright. She was quite forceful, insightful. And all the while she did this, her real primary focus was advancing the cause of African Americans.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's Final Four time. Tonight, in Houston, games pitting Butler against Virginia Commonwealth and UConn against Kentucky will determine which two teams will play for the men's championship on Monday night. Tomorrow, in Indianapolis, the same drill will transpire for the women as Stanford meets Texas A&M and UConn plays Notre Dame. The women's championship will be decided on Tuesday. Both teams and both coaches representing the University of Connecticut have experience in this realm. Under Hall of Famer Jim Calhoun, the men won national championships in 1999 and in 2004, and they've won the Big East title seven times. The UConn women's coach, Gino Auriemma, could be said to rule that realm I mentioned. His teams have won seven national championships. But Boston Globe basketball writer Bob Ryan feels Auriemma will deserve all the credit he'll get if his team wins this championship.
This is the least accomplished of all his teams that have gotten this far. They've so heavily depended on one person, Maya Moore, and they have no depth, and it would be just a phenomenal story. I'm frankly surprised that they've gotten this far.
That sentiment notwithstanding, the Connecticut women have lost just once this season. Perhaps nobody but Bob Ryan is surprised to see them in the Final Four. And certainly nobody is surprised to see Stanford there, since they are the team that beat the Huskies. The same cannot be said of the teams that remain in the men's tournament. Either Butler or Virginia Commonwealth University will play for the championship, and SI.com columnist Paul Daugherty is miffed.
I would have loved to have seen, for example, how Pitt's guards, Ashton Gibbs, Brad Wanamaker, Gilbert Brown, had done against the Morris twins of Kansas. Instead, we get Butler VCU, which, as I wrote, if these two teams were playing in December on ESPN3.com, we wouldn't watch. No knock on either of those teams. They're wonderful, and the story is great. This isn't literature. It's basketball.
Butler would be considered the Cinderella team in this year's tournament if it hadn't been the Cinderella team in last year's tournament. The fans who've marveled at the success of VCU learned this week how that team's head coach, Shaka Smart, motivated his guys following a dreadful stretch in February during which they could not beat anybody. Coach Smart called the lads together and asked them to say goodbye to the calendar page representing that dismal month.
One of those big desk calendars, you know, the ones that people have on their desk. I had a kind of a trash can underneath me at the practice gym there, and the guys were all sitting in front of me, and I had a lighter, and I set it on fire.
On the other side of the men's tournament, the aforementioned UConn, led by head coach Jim Calhoun, will face the University of Kentucky, coached by the mobile John Calipari. UMass and Memphis, two teams previously coached by Calipari, had to vacate wins and achievements because of NCAA violations that occurred when Calipari was supposed to have been in charge. But Bob Ryan, who acknowledges that he and the coach are friends, doesn't think Kentucky will suffer that indignity.
I see a complex human being who has an enormously good side, then he has a naughty boy side. I'm going to let it go with that. On the other half, I certainly hope that won't be the case, and I doubt that it will be. He has assured the world that it would not be the case this time, and so I'm going to have to go with that.
Tonight, VCU and Butler will meet in Houston at 6:09 Eastern Time. Kentucky and UConn will play at 8:49. Tomorrow night in Indianapolis, Texas A&M will face Stanford in the early game at 7, and Notre Dame will try to derail UConn at 9. Some few fortunate college basketball players are on teams that make it to the Final Four. When he was 15, Tabidi Boone felt he could have been one of them. The story of how he did not achieve that goal is perhaps more compelling than anything that could have happened on the basketball court. Tabidi Boone now joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
When you were just 12, you witnessed your mother's attempted suicide. Would it be an exaggeration to say, Tabidi, that from that point on you were essentially responsible for raising yourself and taking care of your brother and sister?
In more ways than one, yeah. I do remember when that situation occurred. It's almost like you go from being this basketball prodigy with goals and dreams and wanting to make it, and you're just a typical kid in the neighborhood. Now, all of a sudden, you get thrust into a situation where now you got to become the big brother, really become the big brother to your sister and brother. I had to really quickly grow up. For me to see something like this at 12, and, you know, here's a mom, you know, who really just felt like at that point in her life she didn't want to live, and to have that kind of horrific situation occur with her, you know, jumping off the roof, you know, I use that as motivation in a positive way. So, yeah, growing up to be the person I am and who I am right now and the things that I believe in, you know, to answer your question, yes, it certainly, you know, made me a young man. As a man at 12 years old.
A little later, you were celebrated as a high school basketball player and as such had every reason to believe that you would play for a top Division I college team. What happened to interrupt that plan?
Well, yeah, I was a high school star, one of the top players to come out of New York City as a point guard, and I was dating a cheerleader. And a little bit too much cheering was going on, and and a baby came. And so it was a very, very difficult situation. And so, you know, when our daughter came, you know, at that time in her life, she was not really prepared to be a mom. So I took the responsibility of taking my daughter with me to college. And what that did, it kind of threw some kind of confusion and dilemma with Division I coaches, top schools, saying at one point, we want to recruit this guy. He's a great player, great athlete. But now he has, you know, this child that he wants to bring into the package. So a lot of Division I coaches had, you know, they backed off from me.
In the article Dan Wetzel wrote about you for Yahoo Sports, he says that when you and your infant daughter Kim arrived at Rochester Institute of Technology, which had a D3 basketball program, you were, quote, equal parts excited and terrified. Did he get that about right?
Yes. I was excited because, like I just said, you know, it was an opportunity for me. And so I was very excited for that. But at the same time, I don't know what to feel to be someone back in 84 to go to a college campus and people was just staring at this guy with a baby, you know, like, you know, what is this, you know? And I got to say to your audience that part of me was nervous that how would people take this guy coming to a campus in a college setting with a child. So, you know, there was some nervousness, you know, along with the excitement of the opportunity.
Was it a hard decision to make, or did you know all along what you were going to do?
No, it was a hard decision. In urban inner cities, there's pretty much three things that young black males are pretty much told that you had to kind of do if you want to feel like any sense of self-worth or accomplishment. That's an athlete, a rap artist, singer, entertainer. The third thing, which is very unfortunate, when you become a hustler in a drug deal and someone that lived this street life that's negative but is very popular, you don't have anybody talking about doctors, lawyers, doing other things, becoming political figures. So in the hood, it's all about basketball. But I want to be able to say I felt that deep down there was something bigger than basketball for me to do. You know, I'm at peace for the decision I made, the choice that I made, you know, and I'm okay. You know, I'm fine with that.
You not only graduated, you found yourself a job and supported your daughter and yourself quite well, and you're currently working on President Obama's Fatherhood and Mentoring Initiative. How did you come to be associated with that program?
Well, he did not have the benefit of the kind of relationship that he wanted and deserved to have with his own father. So when he became president, he decided he wanted to invite some select, you know, prominent individuals and leaders and celebrities and dignitaries that will sit with him and support him and come up with an agenda and an initiative that will begin to address this issue. And so for the last going on 2 years, I've been working with national father leaders around the country. So all that has come into the White House asking me to be a part of what they're doing.
Tabiti, your daughter Kim is now 26 years old. Tell us a little bit about what she's up to.
Oh, man, that's my dream girl there, boy. I tell you, I brought her into the world, but she certainly, you know, she leads me. She is currently on the nursing staff at Georgetown University Hospital. She's in school taking night classes to continue her education around the nursing field. She's happily married to a wonderful, wonderful son-in-law. And I have two great grandsons, Kingston and Kenyon. She turned out great. And I know a lot of that has to do with the fact that a father stayed in her life. And Kim is just a blessing to others. And she's just living a great, wonderful, happy life. And I'm just very proud of her.
I'm sure watching the NCAA tournament games must be a mixed experience for you, knowing that you were good enough at basketball to compete at the highest level. But I understand that last fall you were inducted into the Westchester Community College Sports Hall of Fame. Does that help ease some of the frustration you felt in not having played in the Final Four everybody watches on TV?
Yes, yes, yes. That brought some closure. My Hall of Fame induction is on the same level of NBA, NCAA, any level, because any time anybody can be inducted to any Hall of Fame, that means you will forever go down in history as one of the most accomplished athletes and being a part of something very, very great. I am a Hall of Fame college basketball player, and I finally got my due.
Tabiti Boone, now 47, lives in Brooklyn and, as previously mentioned, works on the President's Fatherhood and Mentoring Initiative. Tabiti, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Bill. I really appreciate it.
Next Friday, Tabiti Boone will represent the Omega Psi Phi fraternity as he talks with Boston Public School kids about academic success and the role of fathers in supporting the next generation of young men. For a link to Dan Wetzel's excellent Yahoo Sports profile of Tabiti Boone, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Shaolin monks in China are working to improve their nation's performance in football, a.k.a. soccer. The project, headed by Shi Yan Lu of the Shaolin Temple, is providing 40 young monks with instruction from both international football players and martial arts experts. Shi Yan Lu has said that the young players have, quote, superb physical qualities as well as a spirit of hard work. He says that he will try to meld the spirit and skills of kung fu into the football training, focusing on such matters as balance and leg strength. The China Football Association has backed the effort by providing 1,000 soccer balls, which you must become, grasshopper, one at a time. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the story of the first woman inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. But first, the 2011 Major League Baseball season is underway, and here, as always, to expound on the beauty of baseball and testify to the Yankee-ness of the Yankees, or lack of same, is ESPN's Tim Kirkchin. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Thursday was, of course, opening day. Was it memorable for you?
Well, it was my 31st opening day, Bill, so those are always memorable when you get over 30. It snowed at Yankee Stadium, and I froze the entire game because I was outside in the dugout watching the game from there. But it was a really interesting game. Curtis Granderson had one of those great opening days that you never forget about, hit the game-winning homer and made two great catches in center field. So even though I complained that it was 42 and snowing at one point, I still thoroughly enjoyed myself.
So based on what you saw, can you say without fear of contradiction that the Yankees are still, in fact, the Yankees?
They are, and they are going to the playoffs again this year. Write it down, Bill. As you know, I'm always right in my predictions. So we can, I can safely say the Yankees are better than people think, seriously. This thought that they're too old and they're just going away, I'm just not buying that.
The defending 2010 World Series champion San Francisco Giants lost on opening day, and they don't seem to be the 2011 World Series choice for a lot of the pundits. What accounts for this?
Well, they really hit their stride late last year. They were a 500 team at the All-Star break. They were still a struggling team in July, and yet they really got hot when it mattered. And I think a lot of people looked at it and said, hey, this team was last in the league with batting average with runners in scoring position. They were last in the league in stolen bases. What they did was they got hot at the right time, and they pitched like crazy down the stretch. And they're going to pitch like crazy all year, and they're going to win their division. I'm pretty certain about that. But I don't like anybody in the postseason more than I like the Phillies in the National League if they get there because of those four starters they have at the top.
Tim, can you explain to me why it is that so many people are absolutely convinced that the Red Sox are going to win the World Series?
Well, I picked him to win the World Series also because I had to make a pick. Now, am I certain of this? Of course not. No one is. However, I can tell you this, Bill. Their lineup is sensational. When you have to wonder all spring, which of the three really quality guys should I hit leadoff here? Which of the four really quality guys should I hit third? Those are the questions facing Terry Francona. There are other teams that don't have a leadoff guy. The Red Sox have three of them. Plus, their bullpen is much better than it was last year, and you have to think their starting rotation is going to make a big difference this year and pitch much better last year, specifically John Lackey and Josh Beckett.
Cubs and Orioles fans have been charitably characterized as being desperate for a winner. Will one or maybe both of these long-suffering groups be rewarded at least with a non-loser this season?
I think they're both going to finish 500 or better, which is really saying something for the Orioles because it was the late 90s the last time they finished over 500. But I think they've really made some strides with Buck Showalter and some of the things that they did in the offseason, like signing Vlad Guerrero. And I think the Cubs are better also. Now, they have a long way to go in a very, well, a semi-difficult division. But I like Mike Quatty, their new manager. I like what he brings, the energy and the enthusiasm. I like some of the things they did in the offseason with Carlos Pena and Matt Garza. But they'll win more games than they'll lose this year, but just barely.
Tim, there has been discussion over the past few months about Albert Pujols. What is he likely to do with the rest of his career? Is he going to be a Cardinal forever?
I think he is, Bill, and I think now I am officially in the minority on this. He is arguably the best player most of us have ever seen, anyone who's 50 years old or younger. He's had basically the best first 10 years of a career, except for maybe Ted Williams. That's how good he has been. And given that, I'm just not sure I can see the Cardinals allowing this guy to walk away when someday he's going to hit his 700th homer, if not his 800th home run. And, you know, there aren't many teams out there that are going to be in the bidding. I can't see the Yankees or the Red Sox in it. Maybe the Angels will get in it. Maybe the Cubs will get in it. But I just cannot see a case where the Cardinals allow the best player in the game to leave and go to the arch rival Cubs. I'm not buying that one.
Tim, the Mets' litany of woes continues. The fans have been offered the opportunity to buy Bernie Madoff jerseys and warm-up jackets. The struggling team took a $25 million loan from the league. They recently released Oliver Perez and Luis Castillo and ate $18 million worth of salary in that deal. Plus, there have been injuries. Jason Bay, Johan Santana, Carlos Beltran, although he seems to be healthier now. And that's only the tip of the iceberg. Aren't the Mets supposed to be one of the league's marquee teams?
Not anymore, Bill. I'm telling you, it's one of the strangest things that's happened there. And the reason they got rid of Perez and Castillo is because the fans there booed them every time they touched the ball. It's a really negative atmosphere around the Mets, other than inside the clubhouse, which I found very, very positive. In fact, Terry Collins, their new manager, organized a bowling league this spring, and all the players just absolutely loved it. I'm not sure this new attitude is going to translate to too many more wins, but here's the bottom line. The Mets would just as soon not play the 2011 season. Get to next year with a healthy Santana and with $55 million off of the books. Until then, the Mets are going to struggle, and I think even they, deep down inside, know it.
All right, NFL players are currently locked out. The NBA collective bargaining agreement expires in June. Are Commissioner Bud et al. Casting a nervous eye toward December 11th, 2011, which is when baseball's labor deal expires?
I don't think so at this point. I mean, baseball labor peace has been pretty good the last two times for the last two collective bargaining agreements, and I think we're going to have three in a row here. Rob Manfred, who negotiates for the owners, and Michael Weiner for the players, have a very good working relationship. There isn't so much hatred back and forth as there used to be 30 years ago or even 20 years ago. Things have really, really changed, and I think everyone in baseball realizes, you know, we've got it pretty good right now. And I think baseball learned its lesson from the 94-95 strike that we just can't do this again and expect people to come back. There'll have to be some work on revenue sharing and luxury taxes and everything else, but I don't think we're going to see any significant changes in the game.
Tim Kirkjian is a reporter for ESPN's Baseball Tonight and a senior writer for ESPN the magazine as well. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
In February, Only a Game's Doug Trabue profiled Division III collegiate swimmer Kendra Stern, who's been posting Division I times while maintaining a dual major in Spanish and art history at Amherst College in western Massachusetts. Last week at the NCAA D3 Championships in Knoxville, Tennessee, Stern won three individual national titles, bringing her career total to 10. Stern was also named National Swimmer of the Year. To hear Doug's story about Kendra Stern, visit our website, onlyagame.org. This week, a symposium on Negro League baseball, sponsored by the New England Sports Museum, brought to Boston a former infielder named Reginald Howard. More than half a century ago, Mr. Howard was employed for two seasons by the Indianapolis Clowns in the Negro Leagues. According to Mr. Howard, among the more committed and energetic owners operating Negro League teams was the only woman currently enshrined in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, Effa Manley.
The Manleys had a very good organization. Effa Manley had some very negative feelings toward Branch Rickey. If you've probably read anything, you probably know about it. And there was a lot of questions a lot of people had. Did Branch Rickey destroy Negro League baseball?
When Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson to a contract, Robinson was playing for the Negro League's Kansas City Monarchs, whom Rickey failed to compensate. While many of the owners of the Negro League teams felt there was nothing they could do about Rickey and others poaching players from their organizations, Effa Manley was not among them.
She was very outspoken, yeah, and a good owner. So Mr. Rickey referred to them as gangsters. Well, Effa Manley said that he was a gangster.
Effa Manley was married to Abe Manley, who owned the Newark Eagles during the 30s and 40s. She served the team as co-owner, de facto co-general manager, representative to league meetings, informal scout, and sometime companion to selected players, meaning players she had selected. Joining me now is Bob Luke, the author of a new biography of Effa Manley titled The Most Famous Woman in Baseball. He joins me now from NPR in Washington. Bob Luke, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill. Nice to be here.
As a business, black baseball was fragile and sometimes unpredictable. Many of the men who owned Negro League teams made their money running numbers, meaning they organized illegal lottery-type operations in the black neighborhoods. This is why Branch Rickey referred to those owners as gangsters, though there were few opportunities for black businessmen to otherwise thrive. You write of Effa Manley that, quote, she kept the Newark Eagles together from 1936 to 1948. Describe her struggle to accomplish that.
Okay, well, Abe Manley, who, as you mentioned, owned the team, did not like the administrative work that went with operating the team. He liked to hang out with the players, go to spring training, make decisions on trades, play poker, drink beer with the players at the Grand Hotel in Newark. So he turned the running of the team over to Effa. So here is Effa. She is about 38 years old. She has spent 15 years in the millinery business in New York City. She's a high school graduate. She is very attractive. She is very bright. And she steps into basically administering the ball club, which means she has to deal with the owners who are rich, middle-aged men, most of whom do not cotton to a woman at the table. Effa was the only woman to ever sit at the table of a Negro League owners meeting. She gave them a piece of her mind on a regular basis, and she was quite forceful, quite insightful. And all the while she did this, her real primary focus was advancing the cause of African Americans, advancing the cause of what she called, in her terms, the race.
You describe Effa Manley as, quote, a light-skinned African American woman, and yet Manley always told interviewers that she was white. Why?
I'm guessing here, but my guess is she preferred to be known as white. The United States Census in 1900 and 1910 lists her race as black. She was the product of a union between her mother, who was white, and a Philadelphia stockbroker. But there is pretty fair evidence that in her mother's background there was some African-American ancestry, which would characterize her as black, at least in those days.
Manley had favorites among the Newark Eagles, and on some occasions she directed the manager, George Giles, to play specific men whom she wanted her women friends to admire. How did manager Giles respond to that?
Not very well. He did not like being told who to start and when to start him. Willie Wells ran into the same situation where Abe Manley ordered Willie, when he was managing the club, to start pitcher Terrence McDuffie, with whom Effa had been having a relationship. Abe knew Terrence was not up to pitching that day, but wanted to make him look bad, ordered Wells to start him. Wells did, but then he called a meeting after the game and resigned. Said he just didn't like being told what to do.
Throughout her career in baseball co-ownership and general management, Effa Manley had a running battle with Satchel Paige. Describe that relationship for us.
Well, Satchel Paige, of course, as you know, was one of the premier pitchers of the Negro Leagues and a premier pitcher of all time. Abe desperately wanted to sign Satchel Paige to play for the Newark Eagles, and at one point had an arrangement with the Pittsburgh Crawfords, where he paid the owner $5,000 for Satchel's contract. Satchel, however, refused to show up in Newark. But he was very attracted to Effa. He wrote Effa a number of letters over the course of 4 or 5 years that, in essence, said, if we can get together, I'd be happy to come and play for the Newark Eagles. Of course, Effa never took him up on that.
But she did want him on the Eagles.
She did want him on the Eagles, yes. But not under his conditions. She didn't want him on the Eagles.
I'm speaking with Bob Luke, the author of The Most Famous Woman in Baseball, and you're listening to Only a Game. In what ways was Effa Manley active in promoting civil rights?
She joined forces with a number of people in Harlem to picket Bloomstein's department store. on 125th Street. Big department store, but would only hire African-Americans as elevator operators, would not hire African-Americans in sales positions where they would have contact with the public. So Effa organized a group to boycott, had picket lines set up in the middle of the summer up and down in front of the store, and met with the owners twice, the first time to no avail. And the second time, she came armed with receipts demonstrating that African-Americans made up maybe 75% of the store's business. And according to Effa, she also said to the owner and the owner's wife, look, in the African-American community, our young women usually only have two choices for jobs. One is as some kind of a domestic. The other is as a prostitute. And according to Effa, I wasn't able to verify this, but according to Effa, that got the Bloomsteins' attention and resulted in their promising to hire, I think it was at that point, 30 African-Americans as sales clerks and more as business demanded it.
Now, in the epilogue, you describe Effa Manley as, quote, the first, only, and likely the last woman to be enshrined in Cooperstown. Do you think she would have enjoyed that distinction?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think she would have been pleased. How could you not be pleased to be in the Hall of Fame? But at the same time, I think she might say the group inducted the wrong Manley, that it should really have been Abe Manley who was inducted into the Hall. She said throughout her whole career that she got way too much credit and publicity and that Abe knew much more about baseball than she did and that her role was basically supporting Abe, of course, though she did it with incredible flourish and verve. And so she, as a result, got all of the publicity and the fame. But she always presented herself publicly and privately as working in support of Abe and seeing him as the main driver.
Bob Luke is the author of The Most Famous Woman in Baseball, Effa Manley and the Negro Leagues. It's published by Potomac Books, and the author joined me from NPR in Washington. Bob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're quite welcome, Bill. My pleasure.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
On Saturday night at a bar in Hollywood, Florida, Jose Canseco was supposed to compete in a celebrity boxing match. He'd been promised $10,000 to do this, five of which he got in advance. Instead of showing up, Canseco sent his twin brother, Ozzy, to the bar. When various patrons noticed that Ozzy's tattoos gave him away as an imposter, the promoter, Damon Feldman, told Ozzy to scram, and he provided a police escort so he would do just that. That, I suppose, would have been that, and not much of that at that, except that Jose Canseco, presumably the real Jose Canseco this time, has complained that Mr. Feldman stiffed him for the second half of his 10 grand. See, Jose, here's the thing. You didn't... never mind. Get me in mucho trouble again. No how, no way, Jose. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, running toward a more promising future by running. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I think I'll just let my promising future come to me.
Okay, well, that's fair, too. Now, I know you had Butler and VCU in your brackets for the Final Four, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's why I'm here doing this and not out of my yacht. Of course it's wonderful. Of course it's a great thing. And what's even better is one of these teams is going to get to play Monday night for the championship.
And what about the women's side?
It's interesting that neither a one nor two seed has made it to the men's Final Four. The women's Final Four is nothing but ones and twos.
Mm-hmm.
The mystery guest is Texas A&M, who beat Baylor in their regional final, but push comes to shove, Connecticut's just better than everybody.
Charlie, the baseball season is underway. I think probably you noticed that. Any reason to believe that the Mets are thoroughly prepared?
I love their new T-shirts. The fan T-shirts with the word Madoff written in the Mets script is my favorite new ballpark gugah. You know, buy a Mets ticket, buy one of these T-shirts, and guarantee you'll be ejected by the third inning.
Lou Gorman, general manager of the Boston Red Sox from 1984 to 1993, died yesterday. How will you be remembering Mr. Gorman?
Well, as an avuncular soul and not a bad baseball guy, three of his teams went to the playoffs in the 10 years he ran the Red Sox, but he was always a pleasure to be around.
The Barry Bonds perjury trial just concluded its second week. I was surprised to learn that ESPN's Mark Fainaruwata and others had been tweeting about the proceedings from the courtroom. OMG, did you know this practice was even allowed? LOL.
LOL, what happened to the case? Basically, Arthur Ting, Barry Bonds' personal orthopedic surgeon, apparently walked his grand jury testimony back over its own feet and blew a big hole, he said, mixing metaphors, in the prosecution's case in this most important scandal in the history of all that there is scandalous.
Did it matter, Charlie, that LeBron James registered a triple-double against his former team, the Cleveland Cavaliers, since on Tuesday night? It was the Cavaliers that won that game?
No, actually, the Cavaliers were 23 points ahead and blew the lead and won anyway. The biggest event of that evening was LeBron James failing to come out for his introductions.
John Junker, who used to be the man in charge of college football's Fiesta Bowl, no longer holds that position. A Fiesta Bowl committee report alleges that Junker took lots of money and did many illegal things with it. Gee whiz, he didn't do something really bad, like give some to the players, did
he? No, he didn't, but John Junker was a junket king. The Junker junkets were quite an amazing thing, including September 12, 2008, where he was taking some folks to a local high-end ecclesiastical parlor in Phoenix and ran up a $1,200 tab. That's a lot of $1 bills.
Meanwhile, a former assistant coach at the University of Kansas has been sentenced to prison for running a multi-million dollar ticket scalping scheme there, and a report this week maintains that back in 2007, a Texas A&M football coach was told that he could have a recruit for $80,000. That was the going rate at that point. Why is all of this surfacing now?
Because it's because this is going to happen every year now during the Final Four because of the enormous percentage of the NCAA's operating budget comes from the basketball tournament. Every year you're going to see a spate of these stories when people come to realize that college sports is essentially the perfect example of a functioning underground economy.
It is not unusual for pro athletes to make large donations to good causes, but golfer Ryo Ishikawa's announcement this week stands out even in that context, don't you think?
He's going to give every dime he makes to the earthquake victims in Japan, and I know which way I'm rooting in every major.
Sidney Crosby joined his Penguins teammates for Thursday's morning skate. He has been out, of course, since January 5th with a concussion. Yet Pittsburgh comfortably remains in the playoff hunt. Based on the nature of his injury and the team's success without him, you think we're going to see him back this year?
I hope not. It looks like they're trying to get him on track to appear sometime during the playoffs. I hope he does take the rest of the year off.
We have discussed many times the imaginative promotions run by minor league baseball teams, and some of them have been terrific. But what do you make of the latest one run by the Akron Arrows? Because I think they're trying to kill their fans.
Don't we have once a year, isn't this becoming a baseball tradition where we have the incredibly gluttonous option at the concession stand? Witness, my friend, in Akron, the Screamer, a 5-pound ice cream sundae. I think they have to use a real batting helmet.
It is. It's a bat that's served in a batting helmet. Absolutely. What is it, 28 scoops of ice cream or something like that?
It is 21 scoops of ice cream, 4 bananas covered with hot fudge sauce, whipped cream, and sprinkles, served in a full-size batting helmet.
There you go.
Once you get them in the park, you fatten them up, and they can never leave.
Can't get out the door.
I can't get out of my chair. I'll stay for the whole series.
And finally, if you're connected to a pro basketball team, say you're the co-owner or minority partner of one, you're not supposed to contact college players who are not yet draft eligible. But what if you're also a famous and wealthy entertainer who just wants to, you know, celebrate with a winner?
Well, I'm sure that this all happened while Coach Cal was out at Vespers, and he would not notice it, as he has not noticed the things going on in his programs at both Memphis and UMass. But Jay-Z was in the Kentucky locker room after they beat North Carolina. The people who are really agitated about it are the people at the NBA who see this as some sort of, you know, temptation for Jay-Z to, like, I don't know, draft the entire Kentucky lineup or something.
Was there any evidence that any of the Kentucky players, as soon as Jay-Z appeared, shouted, no, no, I don't want to be a Net?
I must run away from this famous person, or the NCAA will be angry at me.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and various other books, and, of course, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Last week, I mentioned that when we get cards and letters, not emails now, but actual cards and letters, I gather the Only a Game staff at my desk and we read those cards and letters together, and that's true, and here's proof. So, okay, guys, come on over here. We got a couple of postcards to look at. We got one from Joseph Devine, and it's terrific. Several views of St. Louis on the postcard here. And it starts out, okay, guys, gather around the desk. So, you know, that's what we're going to do.
To
look at the postcard. We're here. He listens to KWMU in St. Louis, does Mr. Devine, and he very much enjoys Charlie Pierce. It says right here in the bottom right-hand corner here.
Do you believe him?
Absolutely, I believe him. Charlie's been on the program for a long time. And we got another card. We got a flood of cards. This one's from Maynard, Massachusetts. Fine aerial view of an old mill in Maynard. Gary, you're
I can see my mother's
Maynard
house.
Kind of guy. Yeah, that's what I thought, mate.
I'm confused, Bill. This appears to be a photograph, but then there's a stamp on the back. I don't understand
Doug,
this technology.
Postcard. Doug, those of us of a certain age, we're familiar with postcards back in the day.
All right, back to work, everyone. This is silly.
We also heard from lots of listeners via email this week. Scott Dillman of Ballston Spa, New York, is unhappy that we didn't pay more attention to the World Cup ski season. He did say, however, that he appreciates that Only a Game, quote, looks at a different side of sports. Bill Caldwell, a WBUR listener, appreciated my interview 2 weeks ago with Neil Langtow about his biography of Roy Campanella. I'm old enough to have been a Bums fan when they were still in Brooklyn, Mr. Caldwell writes. I must have been 3 or 4 when I visited Ebbets Field, though the memory exists only in family lore. However, the memory of Campy's tragic 1958 car accident is etched all too clearly in my mind. The wind went out of my youthful sails. Thanks for the wonderful and sad memories brought back to the surface through your terrific interview. We also heard from Sarah Solnick this week. You know I'm your number one fan, she wrote, but what was that audio clip? I refuse to call it music in this week's show. It sounded like the tone they use for hearing tests. I thought my iPod was malfunctioning. Please try to confine yourselves to more traditional selections. Since the comments about gathering to read postcards worked so well, this week I promise that the entire staff will gather around the warm glow of Doug Trabue's monitor to view our list of new Facebook and Twitter followers. You can find us at Only a Game Radio. You can also leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, and you can send more postcards to Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Give a man a fish and he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish and he eats for a lifetime, or so goes the saying. But there's an advocacy group whose axiom might as well be, give a homeless man running shoes and he stands a fair chance of becoming a productive and healthy member of society. From the city of Brotherly Runners, Britta Conroy Randall has our story.
Before dawn, on a chilly Monday morning, a group of homeless men gather on a street corner in North Philadelphia. Dodging raindrops, they hop from side to side to stay warm. But they're not here by chance. They've come to run.
Got our jumping jacks. You're 25. Ready? Go.
That's Joe Lynch, the team leader of the Back on My Feet running team. He and other volunteers come together 3 times a week to run with people from a nearby homeless shelter.
You're going 3 miles, you're going ridge, you're going to go around Girard College, which is the big stone wall out there, you cannot miss it.
After a stretch and some team announcements, they're off.
All right. everybody stay with somebody, and we'll be good to go.
Back on My Feet started in 2007 with just 6 runners. Since then, the group has grown to serve over 1,000 people. Organised teams, which include the non-homeless, run 3 to 4 mornings a week and reach distances ranging from 1-mile runs to full marathons. Back on My Feet partners with homeless shelters to provide the opportunity to join one of 6 running teams across the city. The organisation provides sneakers, clothing and an orientation. But Back on My Feet Vice President Sandy Merrill says the rest is up to the runners.
It's not about being there because you have to be. Back on My Feet does not provide food. We do not provide their shelter. People who are there because they're opting to be there. They're choosing to be there. And I think in order for someone to really and truly change, that change has to come from a willingness and a desire. And so it's not about forcing someone to be a part of this program. It's about giving them the opportunity and allowing them to make the most of that by coming out every day and giving it their all.
Thomas Young, who's been running with the club for 9 months, says the interaction and emotional support he gets from his teammates have been a major part of his progress.
My life before I started with the group was chaotic, mostly dealt with stealing, robbing, selling drugs, manipulating people. And to be around positive people, college students, people that are working, you know, doing the next right thing is a highly motivated, you know. I ask questions, I talk to people from all walks of life. It helps.
After 2 months with the club, members with at least 90% attendance are offered help with other parts of their lives. Again, Sandy Merrill.
Through building a strength of team and a strength of self through the running program, we allow these individuals to connect with job training opportunities, education opportunities, hiring partners to help them move their lives forward in a way that's self-sustainable.
Temple University is monitoring the program as part of a long-term study on the effect of running on self-esteem. Though the study is not complete, Assistant Professor Jeremy Jordan has already seen some interesting results.
Some of the things we've measured are self-esteem, self-confidence, their ability to feel connected to those around them. I think what's even more important for any runner is that it allows you to keep setting goals. That gives me this level of self-confidence. So yeah, I get the physiological benefit of feeling good after exercising, but it also helps me feel like, you know what, I can do things that previously I thought I couldn't. Those two things combined are very important.
Back on My Feet has expanded to serve homeless communities in Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Boston, Chicago, Dallas, and Indianapolis. Patrick Markey from the Coalition for the Homeless says that most shelters don't have enough resources to provide this sort of program, but this method could be the way forward for combating long-term homelessness. What's more, he says, it's changing the very face of homelessness.
The general public still has a lot of stereotypes about who's homeless. I think the typical person thinks a homeless person is an older man in bedraggled clothing. The reality is much different. A lot of them are folks that are pretty able-bodied. They, you know, having recreational activities, athletic events for them is as important as it would be to anybody who has a home. And anything that helps kind of break the stereotypes but also help homeless people kind of maintain some connection to what were their daily lives, anything like that is going to help.
Sandy Merrill says the spectrum of emotions that members experience as part of the running team can be transferred to everyday life.
Running's the vehicle. It's the microcosm for a lot of life lessons. You know, good, bad, and ugly, the challenges, the struggles, the joys, the opportunities that you get when you're out for a run are very similar to the ones you will feel in life. And so if someone can learn about themselves, how they handle that, that I think is really what makes running such a unique vehicle for this.
Oba Garrett has been running for 9 months and is now working full-time and living in his own apartment. He says running every morning allowed him time to reflect, something he'd never had the opportunity or confidence to do before he started running.
When you do that while you're running, it also helps in the work that you're doing on yourself, the personal inventory that you're doing on yourself in trying to turn your life around, and you're investing in yourself mentally, physically, and spiritually. And to have self-esteem, self-confidence, to walk around with a sense of pride because you're working towards a goal.
Garrett says running is what saved him from returning to the streets. He's now working in security at the State House in Trenton, New Jersey. But beyond that, running allowed him to experience an entirely new feeling.
Running to me means liberation. It means a sense of freedom. That's how I would define running.
Get it in. Back on the street, team members are returning from their runs. As Roland Randolph and Raymond Pickett warm down, they reflect on what keeps them running.
I was a little scared of coming out, committing. But then once I got out here, I've been hooked ever since. I love it. It's a beautiful experience. It's a blast. You don't have to pay me to get out here, put it that way.
It teaches me more discipline. It gives me more positive things to do on my time. I always had it, but it just, like, when you get fed up with certain things, you make your mind go forward and not backwards.
For Only a Game, I'm Britta Conroy Randall.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Mark Filippino. Special thanks this week to Jeremy Bernfeld and to Ed, life coach in training, Gilman. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Boston Globe columnist Bob Ryan, who likes the NCAA tournament.
And it's got this rank outsider who are fulfilling the American dream that anything's possible.
Let's not take it too far, Bob. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.